I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Use math to make the world a better place. Become an actuary through the Society of Actuaries and find solutions to the world's most pressing challenges. As an actuary, the only thing higher than the pay is the satisfaction.
I'm Janet Ellis, and this is Twice Upon a Time, where each week I invite a guest to come and chat with me about their favourite childhood book. They often bring along their own battered copy. This is a podcast to celebrate that magical book which cast a spell over us and often still has us in its thrall. My guest is the renowned potter, designer and judge on television's The Great Pottery Throwdown and former punk, Keith Brimer-Jones. Keith's choice of book is Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe. It was first published in 1719. And many believe it's the first English novel, although it was actually based on the life of a real-life castaway called Alexander Selkirk. There are lots of versions for children, including the one that Keith read, of course, which was, I discovered, only a slightly shorter version of the adult one. Keith Brimer-Jones, thank you so much for sitting there in, actually, where are you? What is that
behind
you?
I'm actually in my studio in Whitstable. Oh. Look, you can see. There, look, we've got a punch bag and we've got the mirror ball. And we've
this is perfectly equipped.
So it's quite a nice place. So I have the studio in Whitstable and then I have a studio also in China, believe it or not.
Do you?
Yeah. So the clue's in the name, China, as in China. And so I go over there when pandemic allows and develop and design stuff over there as well.
Now, thank you for choosing a book. Did you choose this book instantly, the minute we asked you what was your favourite book as a child?
Do you know what? I did, purely because of the images, the pictures. I remember the pictures and I remember the pages. I mean, it was an old book when I was a child, let's face it. And I think I was given it by my grandma, believe it or not, to have a read. And when I was probably about 7 or 8. And of course, I picked it up, and the first thing I looked at was the images. And I am still like that now. I mean, you know, I suffer from dyslexia anyway.
Yes.
So reading this book was somewhat of a challenge.
Well, the book is Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe, illustrated, and I think his name should be pretty much as large as Daniel's, by F.G. Mawson. And the illustrations are phenomenal, aren't they? Starting with
the very
front page, and I have the same copy as you, published in 1949. Yeah. Is yours on that rather stiff wartime paper?
It is. I know. Yeah. It's lovely. And
you can't flick through it, can you?
No, you can't. No, you can't flick through it. No, it's a task in itself, turning the page.
It is.
Which for me is quite nice because I like, when I'm reading, I like to feel like I'm getting somewhere. And it's an event, turning the page over, to be honest. I read quite a bit now, not so much fiction or novels. I read documents and design briefs. I've never been a massive reader, but it has been a very kind of evocative process, actually, you asking me to think about the book of my childhood and Robinson Crusoe. And even the front cover is fairly kind of dubious. You know,
well, I think we just have to have, unfortunately, as this is a recording, but above both of our heads is an illuminated sign going, this is not PC, okay?
No.
Because it's not.
It's
but
not.
On the other hand, it, you know, as to, in terms of what's deemed a classic, in fact.
Yeah.
Robinson Crusoe is definitely up there. It's one of the first ones people mention. And I thought I knew the story until I came to this copy. And then I realised that, first of all, I think my recollection of it is based very much on a 70s children's TV series, which I can sing the theme tune, should it be required, which I only remember two characters in. I think there were more.
Yes.
But in my mind, it was about Robinson Crusoe and then Man Friday. But there are lots more people than that, are there not?
Yeah, I mean, the book is quite complex in the storyline, in the kind of storyline, if you like, and all the different characters within the book. I mean, let's face it, Robinson Crusoe, he got around a bit, didn't he?
He did get around a bit. He did get around a bit, yes, and not always with the best of intentions.
No.
PC-wise. Yes, the way he made his money was a bit dubious. But to take you back to that little boy who's... Did she write inside the book, by the way? Because this copy has an inscription in the front.
Yes.
Which sadly has been scored out by a bookseller, which is a shame. But
also, I was just finishing off the book and I turned a page and a load of pressed leaves fell out of the book. It's amazing. I've still got them in the book. I'm going to keep them in the book. And it was wonderful because I thought, oh, maybe they're from the island.
Do you know what fell out of the copy we have?
Oh, go on.
Old football cards.
Oh,
now, I will
wow.
say these names as though they are, you know, absolutely familiar to me. Paul Reaney.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Bertie Vogt.
Right.
So I think we're talking World Cup time. And Carlos Alberta.
Wow, fantastic.
They are really... pin-up shots, and they are absolutely, absolutely amazing that they fell out of this book, marked page 199, and also a stamp, a Malawian stamp.
Wow.
For sixpence.
Fantastic.
So, you know, all sorts of stories there.
A book is so evocative, isn't it? I mean, as we both described, you know, the editions of this book that we've got here, that, you know, you turn the pages and it's that sort of oxidization of the pages over years. They have a history. And we all have history. And, you know, the gnarled up bits of, you know, the corners of the paper. I do love a book. Let's face it, a book is a design classic. And I don't think we'll ever get rid of them, hopefully. And I say that as not really an avid reader, but they are amazing and an incredibly important part of anyone's culture.
Well, without wishing to sound too winsome then, do you think that something in what the book holds, in its very DNA, in the smell and the look of it and the feel of it, is that connected with the loss of childhood for you?
Yes. Yeah, I would say that. You know, I must admit, the minute I opened the book, the first page, it took me back. It literally did take me back. And actually, in some ways... it took me back to remembering the struggle it was to read and all the things that entailed. But it also took me back to, it's incredible, really. It took me back to remembering my grandparents. It took me back to remembering their garden in Totteridge, which was wonderful, a wonderful big garden that they had. And in the summer, they'd have the old deck chairs out with the canopies over them. You know, real sort of really evocative feelings. And it all really came just from opening the page of this book, regardless of the contents of the book, which is quite amazing in itself.
The illustrations are extraordinary, aren't they?
They're brilliant.
Do you have a favourite one?
I think that my favourite picture in the book is a coloured illustration. And it's Robinson Crusoe in all his glory. He's not surviving anymore. He's actually thriving. You know, he's made an umbrella out of, you know, animal skin, and he's got his gun, and he's got his companion, his parrot there. And it's great because he seems to be quite content and happy with his lot.
It's homely almost.
I know it is.
It's quite,
yeah,
it is.
And I love it. I love it. And I could see myself like that. Really, on a desert island, even to this day.
Have you found the one on my book? It's opposite page 64. And Robinson Crusoe, obviously, the age is showing, or the years on the island are showing a bit, because he's now got a lovely white beard. He's got a little sort of pixie
right.
hat on, but he's also holding a parasol. So he really hasn't left his Englishness very
That's right,
far
yeah.
behind, has he? He's not weathered sufficiently
to
give up the parasol.
He doesn't want to lose his skin tone. You know, he's just like, he's obviously still sort of conscious about his appearance, obviously protecting himself from the sun, which is rather good, yeah.
It's very sweet, actually. I mean, that surprised me, is that some of the pictures, even the sort of boats that sail, you know, when they're besieged by waves, it's not daunting somehow. It does look adventurous.
Predominantly, it's a kind of a book of survival as well as anything else. But you don't feel like Robinson Crusoe's actually surviving. He's going about his daily business. The circumstances that he finds himself in are almost, you know, well, I'm on this island, so I need to make the best of it, really. If it were written today, I think there would be far more about, you know, the survival of actually having to live on a desert island and not having, you know, the right food to eat and how are you going to survive? Whereas with Robinson Crusoe, he's obviously going around killing things and eating things, and he has enough provisions for the time being. He even gets to sow barley and grow barley on the island. Fantastic. I mean, sounds like a farm in Wales, to be honest.
Yeah, and also it sounds like we all want to be there a bit.
Yeah,
because what
we do.
He's successfully done, without necessarily knowing, is that he's actually created a little England.
Surprise, surprise. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. If you were dyslexic, quite frankly, you were deemed as thick. But obviously, as it's transpired, and I could quite honestly say now that if it hadn't have been for dyslexia, I wouldn't be doing the job I'm doing, to be quite honest. Dyslexic people have just a different way of viewing the world. So, Janet, if you're ever moving house and you want me to load your van, just bring me along. And, I'm just a dab hand at Tetris and fixing boxes into spaces. Yeah.
That's it. My son, who was a reluctant reader and also reads very slowly now. I mean, he's now 33. But he also has massive space adapting skills like that. You know,
well,
give him the boxes.
Yeah.
He will create space. Extraordinary.
Well, quite frankly, most architects are dyslexic. Norman Foster is severely dyslexic. And when one has dyslexia, one has a much better affinity of shape, form and volume. That just comes to the fore more than the textual information that you get from words.
But when you were a child, living in a world surrounded by reading, as we know, did you feel out of sorts with the world as you were getting older, or did you just adapt because that was your normal?
No, I did. I must admit, I did feel out of sorts a bit, because it was through education, it was always being impressed upon me that actually, you know, I was a bit of a failure. And it wasn't until I picked up a lump of clay in the first year of secondary school. I had a very inspiring teacher. We all remember an inspiring teacher. And he gave me a lump of clay and said, do something with that. I duly did. I made something that he deemed sort of unusual and good. Then extolled some compliments upon me. I'm talking in the realms of Robinson
Crusoe.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And
we both channeled it.
Yeah, we've both channeled it. And it was to be perfectly honest, it was the first time anyone at school had ever said anything nice about whatever I'd done. And I thought, right, well, I'll keep on this. And I literally took to it the moment I touched the clay. Without sounding too poetic, it was literally an epiphany moment for me.
What was his name and what did you make?
Mr. Mortman, and I made an owl. I made a pottery owl. So I made a simple pinch pot, and then I made another one and I stuck the two together to sort of produce a sphere. And then I did this kind of technique for the feathers on the, I'm 11, by the way, at this time. And I made this technique with a sort of a tool of some feathers. And Mr. Mortman was walking around the room in amongst the other kids that were having a massive clay fight at the time, and said, oh, Keith, that looks rather wonderful what you've done there. That's really interesting. Basically, every lunch hour after school, I was in the pottery room, the art department, and I was the only one, basically, that was doing pottery at this time, to the point where, this is brilliant, in the 80s, Mr. Mortman, picture the scene, we're in the art room at lunch hour, just me and him, and I'm pottering around, and he pipes up and he says, right, now Keith, I'm just going to the staff room for lunch. Now if you fix that kiln, make sure you switch it off before you do it. I mean, brilliant. You wouldn't get away with that now. But and I used to...
The whole scene wouldn't happen now. You would not have a kid spending their lunch hour like that, would you?
Alone just, with another teacher.
Just being allowed inside. You know?
It was fantastic. And I used to fix the kilns at the school. Probably the head didn't know that. But yeah, but to the point where when I reached my sort of A-level sort of stage, why I stayed on, or God knows why, but I did stay on and I did A-level pottery. But I used to bunk off and go to the V&A in the ceramics department, which is quite fantastic, drawing pots and reading about pots, actually. But yeah, I absolutely adored it. Yeah, it was amazing.
Do you still get that same tingle of excitement when you go to the V&A now?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know whether you know, but I get quite emotional around pots.
It has been noted.
and yes, I do. I absolutely love it. I mean, as and when time allows these days, but I do love it. It's one of those kind of museums, and I think they should all be like this, where you can genuinely physically get lost in it. And I used to love that. I used to love it because whatever corner you turned, there was something incredible to look at. And it just really fired my imagination. It was brilliant. And from that, it sparked off my love of clay and all things pottery. Yeah, incredible.
And do 11-year-olds get the chance to do pottery much now at school?
No, they don't. And actually, without going on a massive rant...
Please do.
I would say it's tantamount to criminal because, obviously... Some of us use the left side of the brain and some of us use the right side of the brain. And if you're not allowing children to have these opportunities at an early stage in their education, you're really just really stopping them from seeing the world and really sort of encouraging other opportunities that they may take to. And creative subjects aren't for everyone, but for maybe half the population, they are. And, you know, this country, amongst many other countries, have been built on creativity, of people's dexterity and cognitive endeavours with their hands. To deny that to children at early age is, quite frankly, stupid. So, yeah, I feel very, very strongly that creative subjects in school should be further up the curriculum scale, really. Yeah,
because when you talk about that moment at 11, I can see you are both... that boy and you now, and obviously the two are, you know, two halves of the same, but it's amazing how rapidly you get back to the excitement of that moment.
Yeah.
In your home, given that you weren't a reader by default, was that left aside? Was it frowned on, or did you get constant encouragement, or was it just moved away from?
No, funnily enough, I my mother realised when I was quite young that I obviously had problems reading, with dyslexia. I mean, she was a teacher, so she knew this, and I had extra lessons out of school, reading lessons and all that kind of thing, and it was really, really helpful. But my mother was never sort of pressed me or pressured me into having to be academic. She knew that I was more on the creative spectrum rather than the academic, and fortunately for me, both my parents were very sort of liberal in that way of thinking. And lo and behold, here I am making pots.
Was she a domestic science teacher? Was that right?
She was, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Absolutely.
So did the whole house just smell of cake all the time?
Oh, my God. On a Friday afternoon, if you walked into the house, there were literally about 14, 15 cakes on the go. And when I say cakes, I mean palatial cakes. She was very old school, so there was lots of icing, lots of piping going on. They were incredible. So, yeah, she was a very, very good cook. Yeah, absolutely amazing.
Because this book, the copy we both have, I don't know if yours does. Mine smells of old bookshops, which is actually, I think, one of those scents they now put into candles, you know, for lifestyle choices.
Yeah.
You do a candle range. I think you could incorporate old book.
We did do a candle round. In fact, I'm thinking of bringing it back, actually, funnily enough.
Bring it back.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. An old book range. Yeah. Why not?
Well, maybe yours could be sort of mixed in slightly with cake.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, God, old books and cake. What more do you want in life? Well, maybe alcohol.
Being the third son of the family and not bred to any trade, my head began to be filled very early with rambling thoughts. My father, who was very aged, had given me a competent share of learning as far as house education and the country free school generally goes, and designed me for the law. But I would be satisfied with nothing but going to sea, and this led me so strongly against the will, nay, the commands of my father, and against all the pleas of my mother and other friends, that there seemed to be something fatal in that urge of mine, which led directly to the life of adventure which was to befall me.
So going back to Robinson Crusoe, I can't think I've read every single word in here, because Daniel Defoe's writing style is best described as dense, is it not?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the first sentence takes up quite a lot of time. He's very fond of a semicolon, not much punctuation apart from that, certainly very few full stops.
Yeah.
And underneath all this, underneath this theme of Robinson Crusoe, who has a lot of adventures before he even meets Man Friday, which, like I said, to me anyway, is the famous bit of the book.
Yeah.
You know, he's shipwrecked quite a lot. He has altercations with people. He's actually run away from a middle-class family, hasn't he?
He has, yes.
Was it read to you or did you read it?
No, I did actually read it. And some of the chapters were read to me in bed, as, you know, I think my father read to me in bed. Yeah, and for me, being read to was incredible because it just allowed me to really get my imagination flowing. And even to this day, I love a wilderness. You know, if I were to do Desert Island Discs, I'd be absolutely fine. I might miss Marge, but I would be absolutely fine. I say I might miss. No, I would miss Marge. So I think,
We can edit out that conditional there. Yeah. I'd miss Marge would be. Yeah. But then you've got this story going on. You've got these amazing pictures. So were you him in the book? Were you Robinson or did you find someone else to be?
No, I probably was Robinson. Yeah, without the racist overtones and the imperial the imperial sort of overview of other people. Yeah.
Yeah, that is extraordinary.
I was that person. I was that person making camps and making do, surviving on an island. And you know, I remember in my teens, we go to Wales quite a lot in my teens. And I'd often sort of think about, you know, just walking off into the mountains and surviving with just a penknife. And I'm pretty sure subconsciously it's come from a book like this, really, to fire up that imagination.
Yeah, because it is full of spirit, isn't it, this book? I mean,
it's full of spirit.
Full of spirit and actually analyses the need for human connection. His deprivation makes him very, very keen, actually, on trying to understand who he is, which he's almost ready to know before he meets someone else.
Yes, no, that's true. And in some ways, reading the book, it does sound a bit like a ship's log. Some of it's very factual. And then I did this and then I did that. And actually, quite a lot of the book later in the book, it gets quite gory. I shot at him. He was dead. The other one wasn't quite as dead, you know.
Yeah, because actually that Man Friday only merges into the story really because everybody else he was with was shot. And so, have you read, there's a sequel to this. Have you read it?
No, I haven't read the sequel, no. In fact, I'm intrigued now. I might actually do that.
In that case, I won't say what I was going to say because it's a bit of a spoiler about what happens to Man Friday in the sequel.
Oh, okay.
A little row of dots there, folks. But I think also what you can get from it is a kind of ambition to experience difference, isn't it? I mean, you've said about being the wilderness, but also internally, you know, he's very conscious of the fact that there's nobody to analyse what he's doing. You know, he is creating his world very definitely.
It's incredible what a book at a certain age can do to you subconsciously or maybe consciously, but I'm sure it's instilled that thing. I love traveling and I love going around the world and seeing different cultures. I find myself going to China on a regular basis where the culture couldn't be more different. You literally couldn't walk down the equivalent of a Chinese high street, look into a shop window, see stuff on the shelf, but still have no idea what they're selling. You know, and I kind of love that because it just fascinates me. And obviously, you know, somewhere like China, the text is even different. So you're not even going to see your restaurant name or your bar name to give you a reference point. And that's what I love about this book. Although he is very English, he obviously, I get the fact that he seems to think that being an Englishman is probably the best thing you can be in the world. And he observes everyone from a kind of a sort of hierarchical kind of observation. But he doesn't go too far as to say he's not derogatory about the culture. It's just different. I mean, there's a lot of words of savages in there. And,
yes.
You know, I'm trying to convert him into being a Christian.
There is definitely an overlay. I mean, he reads the Bible, doesn't he? You know, there's an overlay of Christianity through it. Is that something you share?
No. No, it's not. No, it's not. I've never been that religious, although I respect people who are. We all need something to believe in and to have faith in. It's just not my thing. And obviously reading this at 7, 8, 9, religion certainly wasn't something that was really prominent in my life anyway.
Yeah, for some children, I guess it is a sort of background noise of Sunday school or church attendance or whatever. So that would have felt familiar.
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, my mother often used to say, "Oh no, they're a Christian with a large C." That was always her thing, because her father actually was a Methodist minister, the Welsh Chapel. Actually, the Charing Cross Chapel, which then became the Limelight Club, which you and I can probably remember. The Limelight Club was a Welsh Methodist church where my mother actually met my father back in the day. Yeah, who knew? And there I am going in the 80s as a new romantic. It's a totally different story, but there you go.
What happened to the owl, by the way, your first piece?
Well, I'm hoping I've still got it somewhere in storage, because my mother used to keep it by her chair in the front room for years and years and years. It was always on the cabinet by her chair. I'm hoping that my father didn't throw it away when my mother died. And I think I've still got it in storage somewhere.
Oh,
so
I do hope so. Gosh, I really do.
Just like books, for me, making a bit of pottery as a child and keeping that as a keepsake, again, is incredibly evocative when you come across it in later life. It is one of those particular inanimate objects that can instill so much emotion in it. And I think the older that the book, or the older that object is, the more meaning it has in some ways to the owner.
Well, there's something, especially things you make as a child, because I really never got the chance to do pottery. Who knows? But I did make a lot of things. I had a doll that I made clothes for. We travelled around quite a bit when I was a kid. So that was my parents' reason/excuse for not having the bigger items. But everything I really liked was small. I loved dolls' houses. And when I look now at the things that have survived, these little tiny dresses and tiny shoes I made for equally very, very small dolls. I'm doing that. They're about 2 inches high. You know, I look at it now and I think, I can't remember the circumstances of making that. But somehow I can remember how brilliant it was to have the opportunity to do it. Something about that my time was my own for that moment.
Well, that's it with any kind of creative endeavour, to be perfectly honest with you. You don't actually have to be good at making things. It's that process, and it's that psychological process that you go through, and you do lose yourself, as do you when you read a book. It's you and the book, and it's your imagination. And it's very, very similar to when I'm on the wheel. You know, I'm throwing on the wheel. It's my own time. And I lose myself in the process of creating something. It's really, I think it's really, really important for people to actually value that.
And on Pottery Throwdown, on the very first one, when you felt that emotional response to what someone was doing, was there a millisecond where you thought, maybe I shouldn't let people see me cry? Or was it just instant and uncontrollable and right?
No, it was completely instant. In fact, it's a fairly amusing story. So basically, the first 10 minutes of the first episode of the first series of the Pottery Throwdown, we're in the, obviously, the studio room, and all pandemonium's breaking loose because they're having to get their pots in the drying room, and that's the jeopardy, and this, that, and the other. And Raker, one of the potters at the time, was getting his bit in trouble, really. She wasn't going to get her pots in the drying room, and it was all... And I could hear from the monitor room the director going, quick, get some cameras on Rekha, she's in trouble, this, that, the other. And then I was getting really emotional at the whole kind of scenario, and I start, come on, Rekha, and I start crying. And I can hear the director going, my God, one of the judges is crying. This is bloody TV gold. Brilliant. And from then on, I travel halfway across the world to China, and I'll be in a showroom and they'll show me a sample of something that I've designed. And I will start crying if it's a really good sample. And they are quite miffed by that. But I do. It's just triggers.
They're miffed because they don't understand that response.
They don't understand why I'm crying at the piece of ceramic that they presented to me. And my business partner at the time has to say, don't worry, if he's crying, it's a good thing. Yes. If he's crying, it's a good thing. Don't worry.
It is really a good thing.
Yeah.
Because obviously there's to me such a correlation between the way you respond to things as a child, which is honest, you know, you're not worried necessarily about what your peer group, I mean, you want to be in a gang, but even so, your responses, you know, you're not doing it for competitive approval. And yet, when you grow up, you're supposed to lose that a bit, unwittingly, you lose it, force of circumstance, and you're supposed to then get in that stream of kind of keeping up, competing, seeing who's doing what.
Growing upness,
yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Your response seems to me primal in all the best ways, you know, in the way that we absolutely should respond to things. And yet we're kind of encouraged to feel a bit embarrassed about it.
You know, if you don't allow children to express themselves creatively, and I don't mean run around a supermarket, you know, shouting, I want this, mum, and I want that. I mean, express themselves creatively in a constructive environment. Then you are dumbing down their senses. And you know, as you quite rightly just described, as we grow older, that gets drummed out of us as though that's not really the right thing to do. And that's not right. That's really not right. You know, the reason why I get so emotional, especially on the show, is because I have someone in front of me. I'll start crying now. I have someone in front of me that has created something that's really quite personal to them. Under duress, let's face it, on a television program, and they are giving all their all to me in this item that's on the judging bench, and we are communicating through what they've created. And if they've done a really, really wonderful job at that, I can't help but get overjoyed. I literally can't.
No, and neither should you.
It's fantastic. Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah, and it's a very privileged position to be on, I must say. It really is. Yeah.
A lot of the work you do now as a potter is concerned with words. They're all over what you do. So have you made friends with them at last?
Well, I have. Of course I have. And it's the irony is that the biggest range that I do is called the word range, you know, the Keith Brimer Jones word range. And the reason for that is because, you know, again, I suppose tapping into that early childhood, the way I look at words, first and foremost, is the shape of the words. One of the words that I love the most from aesthetic reasons is the word hot. I just like it. I like the word hot, the shape of it, that the H and then the O in the middle centralizes the whole kind of format of the word. And so therefore I thought, well, I'll put that on a mug. I mean, you know, obviously it's conducive related to, you know, ironically to putting on a mug. Word hot, hot coffee, hot tea. And that's how the word range came about. So it is quite amazing because it was the aesthetic look of words that got me doing the word range. So, you know, even if one struggles with something in life, you can find a positivity out of that. One of my favorite quotes of all time is, a pessimist's problem is an optimist's opportunity. And I do live my life by that phrase, really.
That is a brilliant place to end on. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. This has been Twice Upon a Time with me, Janet Ellis. My guest was Keith Brimer Jones. The producer is Caroline Raphael. Recording and post-production by John Wakefield and Diggory Waite.
All the titles mentioned are on the podcast show page. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at @TwiceUponAPod for pictures of our guests and their brilliant books. And if you like the show, do recommend to a friend or leave us a review. The executive producer is Claire Broughton, and Twice Upon a Time is a Hat Trick podcast.
Time is valuable. That's why Lowe's Blueprint Takeoffs turn blueprints into quotes faster. Bring us your plans, and we'll generate itemized material lists to make quoting easier so you can get back to building. Plus, at the Lowe's Pro Desk, you get access to thousands of building materials not sold in store. And when your order's ready, we'll deliver everything to the job site. Improving is easy at Lowe's.
Hello, America. It's your new favourite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two fourths of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.